Oh, choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. Four new bridges are being built along the I-90 corridor, in Factoria, but they're not for cars, and they're not for bikes. They are for the fish, and here's Chris.
This is one of the most ambitious fish passage recovery projects in the state to date. The state needs to replace the series of pipes and culverts that connects Sunset Creek, which runs behind the T-Mobile campus there on the south side of the freeway in Factoria, over to the Humane Society in Bellevue on the north side of I-90. Ryan Boyle is the environmental biologist on this project. What kind of fish use this creek?
Documented coho salmon in that stream, and they've been seen spawning in there. We've spotted a 10-inch trout, local resident trout, cutthroat, smaller chance at steelhead or rainbow trout, and a little bit of a chance of Chinook salmon.
I bet you had no idea that salmon were trying to work their way through the creek under I-90.
Didn't even know that creek existed.
Yeah, it's just, you wouldn't even know it unless you're right there. It's kind of along the walkway there. There's just a little strip of green space.
So it drains into the slough then?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And so it's just one of those smaller little things but that you wouldn't never even notice. Now, I put some pictures up at mynorthwest.com to show you what the fish passage looks like today. It's basically just a series of pipes, and it doesn't give the fish a good chance to get upstream.
A very long, very steep pipe right now. The best of fishes really couldn't swim up it. It's just velocity is too high in the water. It's just too steep. They just don't have the physical power to get up there.
To clear out enough space to return Sunset Creek to a more normal state, workers will need to dig down about 60 feet under two roads and all of I-90. Project engineer Seth Belknap.
To do this, we are constructing four bridges. One on westbound I-90, one on eastbound I-90, as well as one on southeast 36th Street and southeast East Gateway.
Now, when we think of bridges, obviously we think of something above ground. These are bridges that are going to be underground, if you think about it. They're going to build little boxes underneath the freeway, which count as a bridge, to expand the creek underneath and let it have actually some room to breathe underneath in there with trees and all sorts of things that are going to build into this. So they're going to be dug out from above down to the creek bed. Larry Smith is with Atkinson Construction, which is the contractor on the job. His team's going to build these bridges in stages, working from south to north across the roads and the freeway. And they will need to close lanes on the freeway in stages over the next few years to get this done.
We'll dig down a little bit, enough room to get an abutment put in and some girders set, and then we'll build the deck and allow us to detour traffic on top of it. So we'll have shallow foundations, precast girders, and a cast-in-place deck that put traffic back on it. Then we flop to the other half and build the other half.
Drivers have already seen the eastbound I-90 HOV lane blocked for a while. This is just the start of the preparation for this project. The cranes and heavy machinery are going to arrive in June. Eastbound bridges over I-90 will be finished this year, so that eastbound lanes will see the impact this year. Then westbound work will begin in 2024. WashDOT's Belknap says it's a challenge to keep traffic moving during such a complex project.
The main goal is to keep people moving on I-90, as well as the local streets. So we will be constructing the bridges in halves, essentially, and shifting traffic around the work zone.
Southeast 36th, which runs along eastbound I-90 there, will have one alternating lane of traffic for about 18 months. Once the work on East Gateway begins next year, it's going to have to be closed entirely. That's going to be a huge issue for people trying to get to the park and ride and to Bellevue College. So we'll be keeping you up to date on the closures as these change. But I want to give everybody kind of a heads up on this, that over the next couple of construction seasons, there's going to be a lot going on right there, and there's nothing going to be apparently being built. It's all underneath the freeway there, so you just need to be aware if you're wondering what's happening there. Well, it's underneath you is what they're doing there.
So it's a bridge underneath the freeway?
That is correct.
Why is it called a bridge?
Well, because it's still technically, I mean, that's what they call it, because it's a bridge over water, but it's just there. It's going to be built underneath the freeway. So in order to do that, they've got to build and support the freeway, which is now supported by concrete street and the culverts go through then they're going to take that out, dig down to the creek, and then restore the creek as best they can and make so it.
They're just basically widening the culverts to go under the freeway.
Though. Right. Well, the culverts right now are pipes, though. They're going to they're going to dig it down and make it a natural stream again, throwing rocks and some trees and all sorts of stuff.
Be a trail down there so we can see the results of this $1 million construction.
I'm not sure. They promised me that they let me out into the construction zone a couple times so we can get in there and take a look, get some pictures in there. I'm not sure if you'll be able to walk underneath it, but there is a path on the north and south side right there.
It's like a boardwalk.
Exactly. So we'll see if they'll let you go underneath it. I don't see why not, but yeah, we'll see as it goes.
I want cameras.
You want to see what's happening, kind of like the I-90.
See the fish.
Yeah, well, because I think that's a good point too, is because a lot of people are like, oh well, geez, there's a stream. How do we even know what's the But yeah. I mean, it would be great, kind of like I love the I-90 Wildlife Passage Bridge, east of Easton, because and then you get to see the animals crossing there, like, okay, they're using it.
Well, there's also a great trail up off 520 through the north end of the Arboretum.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The wetlands. And so you think, like, in 20 years, Lake Washington will turn into a commercial salmon fishery?
Oh, that would be great, wouldn't it? With all the fish passage work that we're doing? Yeah, that would be fabulous, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Just lower your line and pull up dinner.
Like the old days.
That's right. Like the old days. Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's get the Ukraine update with CBS military analyst and retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland. Jeff, I saw some coverage of a series of drone strikes in Moscow. And when Ukrainian authorities were asked about that, they said basically, we had nothing to do with it directly. Who was responsible for this? Do you know?
Well, it's a little bit hard to say, Dave. It could certainly be the Ukrainians, their intelligence services. That doesn't mean necessarily that President Zelensky authorized himself. We've also got these groups, the so-called anti-Russian or the Russian Volunteer Corps, who have conducted ground attacks in Belgorod and along the perimeter of Russia over the last week or so. So it could be either of those groups. There's an outstanding possibility, frankly, it's the Russians themselves, though I don't think that's likely. But we've seen Vladimir Putin in the past, for example, conduct attacks in Moscow early in his time as president of Russia to drum up popular support for the conflict in that time in Chechnya and perhaps today. And I think that's unlikely, as Putin has been really surprisingly moot about the attacks again in Belgorod there on the border, as well as said nothing about this particular drone attack earlier today.
Could this be a problem for Ukraine's image in the world? Because if this turns out to be, okay, since they hit our apartment buildings and killed innocent people, we're going to try to hit their apartment buildings and kill innocent people, could that hurt their support?
It possibly could, certainly in the so-called global south, where the Ukrainians have been trying to drum up support. Think of places in South America, Africa, India, and the like. And don't forget, Zelensky made a trip to meet with the Arab League. On his way to the G7 meeting, just try to break through with that group. So it's possible it might dampen down their willingness to support Ukraine. That being said, if you look at dramatic attacks that have occurred against Ukraine for many months, and we've seen in the last couple of days the largest series of drone attacks against Kyiv that we've seen in this particular war, I would tend to doubt it. Furthermore, I think in this particular case, though they hit some residential buildings and which resulted in some damage, it's possible that was really because the drones apparently were either shot down or were were spoofed by electronic warfare. So it's unclear to me if those particular apartment buildings were the intended target or just after they were crashed or shot down or spoofed, some of the wreckage from the drones actually struck the building.
CBS News military analyst Jeff McCausland. Jeff, thank you.
Always a pleasure, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Joining us is CBS congressional correspondent Scott McFarlane in Washington, D.C. There is a debt limit deal. The question is, what's the next step? Will it pass Congress? Scott, set this up for us.
The trajectory is good so far, but time is the enemy when there's confrontational and contentious pieces of legislation. The more time you give it, the more room you give opposition to grow and metastasize. A pivotal House committee, the House Rules Committee, meets early this afternoon here in Washington, D.C. to give preliminary approval to this bill. There are a couple dissenting voices in the majority, in the Republican Party, who are firm noes on this bill They likely can't stop it from coming out of the committee, but they can try to bloody this bill up and try to galvanize opposition. Again, time's the enemy with the vote coming no sooner than tomorrow.
Now, I know there's a lot in this. My overall question is, supposing this passes and is put into effect, who feels it? Does anybody feel it?
Well, Democrats, including members of the Progressive Caucus, including Congresswoman Jayapal of Washington State, say low-income families are going to feel this in a bad way, that among the things they're doing here is tightening eligibility and expanding restrictions for social safety net programs. Think food stamps, things help for the poor. That if that's part of the change that's being affected by this legislation, then people on the lower scales of the income world are going to feel this directly. But also, there are changes to environmental permitting rules, environmental rules, loosening environmental restrictions, which means that it's possible that the global climate change could feel this. Mm-hmm. But also, I think it's important to note that politically, this pushes the debt ceiling debate back until January 2025. They won't have to revisit this, Dave, until after the 2024 election. So politically, they're all going to feel the benefit of this.
Does it save any money? Do our taxes go down?
Ultimately, they're going to argue this could save trillions, that this has the potential of saving up to $2 trillion over the next set of years, if not the next few years.
Really?
Your taxes go down? There's no tax policy change in this legislation. That was one of the things that was negotiated. So you should feel no changes in your taxes at all. And I think Republicans would argue that's a victory because they say the White House was arguing to raise some taxes on some Americans to help reduce the deficit. And there's two ways to reduce the deficit. You increase revenues, you increase taxes, or you significantly chop spending. But taxes were off the table, and so are real ways of cutting spending. I mean, they took Social Security, Medicare, the military, and veterans off the table.
Right.
That's where America spends its money. They're going to be saving by cutting the IRS, by cutting social safety net programs, by cutting domestically in programs that really are popular for some Democrats and for many Americans across the country.
That's the part that bugs me. They cut the IRS appropriation, which was intended to hire more agents who could enforce the tax laws to recapture some of the $1 trillion in taxes owed that are not paid every year. How does that help balance the budget?
You're going to hear that argument over and over the next 24 to 48 hours, that this was a knucklehead thing to do if you're trying to reduce the deficit. Cutting the IRS cuts the ability to collect money and pay down deficits and pay down debt.
Exactly. So, and the one more thing on cutting some of the safety net programs. Of course, Seattle, like a lot of cities, has a homelessness problem. This is not going to lead to more tents, is it?
In this case, I think what Republicans would argue is that this is a correction that will incentivize work, that these are people that are being impacted who could otherwise work or should otherwise work. This is an old bromide of a dispute between Republicans and Democrats they've been having for generations. They have put this into a debt ceiling bill, and there are any number of members of Congress who say this is not the time and place to have this argument. If we're going to argue over social safety net programs, let's do it in regular order and not by putting a gun to the head of the American economy.
So what do you think? Does this pass or not?
At this moment, it looks good. The odds are favorable, but time is the enemy. If they don't have that vote tomorrow in the U.S. House as projected, that's trouble. Because the more time and oxygen you give it, the more time and oxygen you give those trying to galvanize opposition. But there's so many endorsements, Dave. Chamber of Commerce, the moderate Democrats, the moderate Republicans, groups that are strictly into nonpartisan studies of the economy are all in favor of this. There's a lot of fig leaves for members of Congress to take what may be a tough vote.
And actually, this could all be reversed if Biden and the Democrats win the next election, couldn't it?
This could be reversed if the political complexion changes either way.
Yeah, well, that's true.
what you have here is a distinctive alliance that's worth underscoring. You have the President of the United States and the Republican House Speaker working in concert on something. And that itself makes this a singularly distinctive moment at this political era in American history.
CBS News Congressional Correspondent Scott McFarland. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The Supreme Court session is winding down. Let's get a look at the higher profile cases yet to be decided with CBS contributor and law professor Thane Rosenbaum. I think one of the biggest ones, it's fair to say, is affirmative action. We have Harvard and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, being sued over giving preferential treatment to black students, being sued by whites and Asian groups, basically, saying that admissions should be colorblind. So read the tea leaves on this one. Is the Supreme Court about to revise affirmative action?
So the idea of favoring racial preferences has always been connected and has been accepted because there's an overall value to everyone's education through diversity. So this case is really an attack on diversity because Asians are saying we are being discriminated against under the Civil Rights Act. How is it possible that since we're minorities and we are supposed to be connected and protected under the Civil Rights Act, that it turns out that we're being discriminated against because on pure merit alone, we would deserve to get into both mirror. The reason that Harvard and University of North Carolina is that the plaintiffs picked what they consider the best two schools from private and public. So that's why you have, you know, both of those being challenged. And so the question is, in terms of reading the tea leaves, it did look at the oral argument as though that the Supreme Court was taking a very critical look at the concept of diversity to say this is no longer just about racially preferring African-Americans to assist them. It's really that it improves the educational experience for everyone to have a diverse class. And it did seem, at least the conservative majority, is not convinced of that at all. They just seem to say, well, I just don't see the benefit of that. And Harvard was taking a very strong position that if we did it solely on the basis of on merit, we would have a much less interesting class.
One of the things that has changed on this issue is that we are no longer talking, in many cases, about an equal education, but in fact of adopting policies that are deliberately race conscious. And I'm thinking about these various reparation plans in cities and states around the country, where, for example, I believe in California, the commission there is going to try to do ancestry tracing to see who was, not just because of your skin color, but who was actually the son or daughter of a family that had slave owning in its background. In other words, race has become more important as a qualifier, but for what a lot of people would say are legitimate historical reasons. Could this case have repercussions with those efforts?
So that goes to a different point, which is that Martin Luther King was saying is that we don't want to be judged according to the color of our skin, but rather by the content of our character, right? That what we're looking for is equality of opportunity. And that was really what the understanding was of the civil rights movement, that color should not be an impediment to having the same opportunities. What you're hearing now within the progressive community is forget equality of opportunity. We want something called equity. Very different. What is that? Equity is saying we want to be represented based on our numbers in the population. So if we're 15% of the population, we want to be 15% of the doctors. We want to be 15% of the engineers. We want, and the argument that the progressives have been making, which is very controversial, is that if we're not represented according to our numbers in every category, right? This is cuts to the even reparations argument. The only reason that's true is because of racism. It's not because of merit. It's not because of hard work. It's not because of all the things that the oppressor groups have been saying about us. It's simply because of racism. And that's really where the reparations debate comes from. It's a much more aggressive position that says equality of opportunity is not enough because in the end, we are still being discriminated against. And you know what the evidence is? We are not fairly represented in our numbers in all these categories. And it can only be one reason, because of racism.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that if the court basically reverses affirmative action, the reparations idea would be a non-starter with them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's true. That, you know, if the argument is that diversity is not a reason to discriminate against other people, right, in order to achieve equity, right, then that would apply across the board, that the argument for diversity is not the reason that the civil rights movement felt strongly about affirmative action. It was really for the purposes of addressing a racial history that needed to be corrected by giving people more opportunity and not simply on the basis of diversity alone.
Another case before the Supreme Court involves a familiar issue, and that is a merchant required to provide services for somebody whose sexual orientation they can't stand? In this case, we've had cakes, we've had photographs, and now we have a website designer. Does this case have the potential to overturn decisions in those previous cases?
So, right, you're right. And it's interesting that you mentioned cake, because these cases, two of them are really right out of Colorado. And here's the argument. The argument is, in this case, the one is that we have a web designer who's saying, I'm an artist, and I have a First Amendment right to express myself freely, freedom of expression. And you can't tell me how to compel me to make my art in a way that I don't approve of. I have a right to speak, and I have a right not to be compelled to speak, right? Two points. I get to speak what I want to speak and express myself in a particular way. And as an artist, you can't force me to express myself or to make art. So therefore, if I don't approve of a same-sex couple or marriage, you can't force me to create a website for something that I don't agree in. You can't compel me. We saw this with the Master Cake case that didn't really get resolved according to this. Why is this important? In that case, you had a guy who literally said, I'm not just any baker. I'm the master cake baker. And therefore, this is not just my religious identity. It's my First Amendment rights to speak and to express myself freely.
CBS contributor and law professor Thane Rosenbaum. Thane, thank you.
Anytime, Dave. Thank you.
Time for your daily dose of kindness, brought to you by Robert W. Baird, focused on your financial needs since 1919. And I think for the first time in Daily Dose of Kindness history, it's been going on, 7, 8 years now? I have my own personal story of kindness.
Really?
To share. Yes. This weekend, I stopped by my local Goodwill. Love a good thrift. Love a good dopamine shopping trip. You know, buy something cheap, get that dopamine hit, feels good. You're happy for the rest of the day. It's a coping mechanism. All right. Lay off. Nobody's bothering me. But I walked in. And as I walked in, I noticed a man with one of those walkers, you know, the ones where you can also sit if you want. It's got a seat on it. He was struggling to get in the door. So naturally, I go over and I hold open the door for him. And as he's coming in, he goes, don't go anywhere. Don't go anywhere. And I was like, okay, you know, what else do you need? I thought maybe he needed help with his walk or something like that. And he reaches into his little satchel that's attached to his walker and he produces this block of wood to me. Now, it looks like, 2x4 that he cut into pieces.
This actual piece of wood you have in your hand?
This actual piece of wood I have in my hand, Dave. I know this is radio, but just imagine a piece of wood, right? Nope. And he glued a piece of paper on top. So, Dave, read the piece of paper.
It says, exercise block. Number one, place block on floor. Number two, walk around block 2 times. Number three, sit down and relax. If anyone asks, have you exercised today, tell them you walked around the block twice.
So, you know, you can imagine, like, I'm handed this piece of wood and I'm like, okay, I'm reading it and I'm thinking, oh gosh, is this going to be like a sales pitch? Is this going to be something weird? And he ends up giving me, you know, I wasn't in a bad mood, but I also wasn't in a great mood. And I was just in a mood, right? That's why I was dopamine shopping at the thrift store. And he gave me such a smile, and that smile lasted all day because of this joke, right? And unassuming older man, and he had multiple blocks of wood.
Oh, but he did.
In his, and he hands them out to people to give them a smile. Then he said, wait, that's not it. That's not it. And he hands me this piece of paper that says, a hug is a great gift, one size fits all, and it's easy to exchange.
Look at that.
So two little messages that have absolutely made my, you know, almost week now. I've kept these within sight ever since he gave them to me, and I didn't catch his name. I think I was so taken aback by the exchange that I forgot to say thank you for for doing this. What's your name? And but I did want to talk about it because these are the best kinds of kindness, the ones that come out of nowhere from strangers. It didn't really cost him anything to make this. He just gave it to me because I held the door open for him, and he's now every time I think of it I smile. So it really, it's like a ripple effect when you're kind to people.
And when you turn to look back at him, was he gone? Did he like magically disappear?
Exactly. Yeah, he evaporated. And I was like, wait. I felt his essence. So anyways, funny joke about the block of wood. And
that's very good.
I just want to thank him. Maybe he's a listener. I don't know.
That's very sweet.
Yeah.
7:48, Seattle's Morning News. And now from the G and Ursula Show, here is G Scott to talk about the etiquette on airplanes. Whether you can seriously, now they're saying you can't ever recline your seat on an airplane like they recline at all anyway. It's like 2 inches.
I mean, look, I'm glad we're having this discussion. It's not, they're not telling you that you can't. They're kind of nudging towards, Colleen, like you shouldn't, if you will. What we need to do is this. First, we all need to understand that on the planes, right, it's tight. Right. And we are all trying to get to our destination as comfortable as possible. Right. So here's what you don't want to do. You don't want to just be chilling there. And then once the captain comes on and tell you that you're above 10,000 feet and, you know, letting you know that you can walk about the cabin, you can go to your restroom. You don't want to bam, you know, put your seat back real hard.
You don't do it violently.
You don't do it that way.
Yeah.
Check your surroundings. Look back, like, oh, there's a little child back there. Cool, I'm good.
Yeah.
You look back and you see somebody that's about Dave Ross's height. You good. You know what I mean? But then you see somebody that's about 6'1 plus, 6'2. Then you're like,
No.
Gauge it.
I'm sorry. I'm not going to risk my comfort because I just so happen to have a neighbor behind me who's tall. That person could go to first class. If they want the leg room, they can have the aisle. You know what I'm saying? Like, I paid for this seat. I'm going to recline it smoothly and politely, but I'm going to recline it.
Okay. That's fair.
I have to make concessions all the time.
But how about when it's Colleen is now 6'4"? Colleen is 6'4". Uh-huh. Colleen is sitting there. She's not in first class. Yeah. And Colleen has the attitude of, I'm going to lean back when I want to. But I think you're going to have a little pause about someone else in front of you making that lean back. You know what I mean?
No, it's their right because I reserve the right to recline my seat. So if somebody wants to. Listen.
Yeah.
Flying is no longer comfortable, luxurious, stylish,
right. Fancy.
I mean, unless you're in first class, flying is a schlep. So I'm going to wear my sweatpants. I'm going to wear my tennis shoes. I'm not dressing up. I'm not getting, you know, people are always like, remember when the days of flying were, it was so glamorous. And
that's what Dave
dressed
told
up.
Us. He told
no,
us that.
Thank you,
they,
unless you're in first
and
class.
And smoke cigarettes
right.
in
so
the back.
Let's, we're all in this together.
Yeah.
Kids are going to be noisy. The food is going to suck.
Colleen!
And we're going to get comfortable together.
Colleen, what's in that water bottle?
What are you talking about?
I mean, come on now. You got to get on the plane. Don't you want to be kind?
I'm paying $500 for an economy seat that smells like a toilet because it's by the toilet. I'm going to do whatever is well within my right to be a little bit comfortable.
I'm not even going to argue with you.
You can't, because I'm right.
Okay.
I know you came in here thinking that you had the argument to win all arguments.
Yeah.
But when you think about the reality of flying, they have put us in a position where instead of saying, hey, airplane makers, hey, airlines, can you make the price of this ticket match the experience? Instead, they have us pitting each other against each other. should we recline? The problem isn't whether we should recline. The problem is that the seats are too small and don't recline enough.
I mean, but what we don't want to do is we don't want to raise. First of all, airplane tickets at the price that they are now are still pretty good, considering that over the years they haven't really gone up that crazy, right? Like, I think plane tickets are still reasonable.
Depending on your budget.
I mean, hold on.
When was the last time you flew coach?
When was the last time you flew coach?
When I came back from Arizona. So that was, I think, almost a month and a half ago. But, hey, you start flying, you know, Midwest and all that kind of stuff, you got to jump in that first class. I like first class. I also get water at fast food joints. You know what I mean? It's subjective. But I didn't want to come in here. I didn't want to come in here on that, well, you need to buy first class, because that's not realistic for everyone. I just try to do the, hey, the person behind me, 9 times out of 10, the person behind you is not 6'1 plus. Mm. They're just not. Or else they try to get in the exit row, or they try to get in the premium seats, which is the first two rows behind first class. But, you know, I don't know. We just try to do the best we can. My only problem, the storage bins. I can't stand some of y'all with these storage bins. You get on, you know that your seat, you know your seat is at 28C.
And you slip your suitcase.
And you slip your stuff in 7B. Yeah. Come on, player.
It's survival of the fittest. That's the way it is on a plane.
I just never liked a hierarchy, even on an airplane.
I'm going to go do this survey in Mercer Island and see what happens.
See what happens. He's got this thing about Mercer Island.
I know. He was just peppering you with questions.
You should come visit sometime.
You're inviting Nick Allard to Mercer Island? No. Wow. I'm going to tell Nick.
So much happening in Washington, which is why we called David Farenthold from the New York Times. So, David, we have a debt deal, and I thought that Wall Street would be happy, but the Dow stocks are down 130 points. So is this is there a possibility that this might not pass?
Well, there's a big vote today in a House committee that will show us whether it will pass or not. But I do think this will pass. There are a lot of Republicans who are going to vote no, but I think enough Democrats will vote yes that they will save it.
Okay, and so what does this change exactly? Does this in fact change the direction of the national debt?
No, not at all. This basically caps spending on some parts of the federal budget. But when we say caps, meaning if they will grow, but they will probably grow less than they would have otherwise. Basically, what this is the Republicans coming in controlling the House were going to have to make some sort of deal with Biden about spending, and they were going to use their leverage to try to lower the trajectory of U.S. spending. And so they did it in the context of this debt deal rather than in the context, the sort of normal context of an appropriations bill. Mm-hmm. But none of it changes the overall trajectory of our spending. It just makes it a little bit lower than it might have been.
That's stupid. Well, I mean, we've been arguing about this for how many weeks? And I thought there was going to be some real change. I mean, are they really so afraid about raising taxes on, I think it's like the top 5%, right, that are holding back most of the legally owed tax money? Are they so scared of these guys that they couldn't throw any bones to us in the form of collecting more money, enough money to actually reduce the trajectory of the debt?
No. In fact, the biggest change this makes is to take some enforcement money away from the IRS. So, like, the people who would have gone out and collected more taxes, Republicans insisted that they get less money. So, yeah, the one sort of easy fix, which is to make the rich pay their fair share, pay the CEO, is going to get weakened by this deal.
And Lindsey Graham's objection was that there was not enough, was that Biden did hold the line on defense, and he's holding out for spending even more money on defense. What sense does that make?
That's the thing about the Republicans, is that they have a very small minority in the House, I mean, majority in the House. Obviously, Graham's in the Senate, but their priorities are all over the place. There's some people who just want to vote no matter what it is, like Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene. There's some people who want to cut spending overall, and there's people like Graham who want to increase it to the Pentagon, a place where you know, lots and lots of the studies have shown that the contractors the Pentagon uses overcharge us for everything. So there's no uniform policy position that makes any sense on the Republican side. I think this was destined to be a small deal, which it is.
Okay, so what about going forward? There is a budget process underway, is there not?
There is. I think this, we just saw it. I mean, it's so rare that it happens, that the appropriations process happens sort of as it's designed to. It always sort of seems to happen at the last minute. And in this case, it seems to have happened in the last minute in the context of this debt deal. So maybe that means there's less of a chance of a government shutdown coming up whenever in September when the money expires. But this doesn't seem like anything.
There's still a shutdown on the table besides?
Well, there's always a shutdown because Republicans could threaten not to pass an appropriations bill. But this, it seems like they've agreed on a framework for spending money that the appropriations bills could follow. So there won't be any sort of big unbridged gaps when that comes around at the end of the fiscal year.
And I heard Lindsey Graham complain the other day that with the defense budget just holding, as you said, since it's holding steady, it's actually declining because it's not keeping track with inflation, that we could lose to the Chinese Navy or something like that. So if he's really afraid of doing that, why don't they go through a budget process with the Department of Defense and then raise the money from the rich people who are, again, illegally withholding it so we don't sink the Navy? I don't see why that would be such a toxic idea.
Yeah, I mean, if you were going to really change the way the Pentagon works and how we spend the money on the Pentagon, I mean, the Pentagon has a lot of its own problems spending money. But one of the reasons, the biggest problems with the Pentagon's budget is Congress. Congress adds in all this stuff that the Pentagon doesn't even want. There's a whole class of ship that Congress wants because it's made in the U.S. by powerful contractors. But the Navy said, look, we don't even want, and it doesn't work, but they keep making them and manning them as sailors.
Which ship is this? There's a ship that we're making them use that they don't want?
Yeah, it's a thing called Littoral. Combat ship. Some very powerful contractor makes it, but they don't really work that well, and the Navy said it again and again that they don't want it. So, and also it wouldn't help us with China because it only fights in the near shore. So, yeah, there's, you know, this is not what's going to hold us back in a fight with China. In a fight with China, there's going to be, maybe we would lose or maybe very powerful, very damaging because it will happen on their turf and not ours. But this budget cycle will not be the reason.
Well, that sounds like a scandal. If the Republicans are trying to save money, why isn't Lindsey Graham blowing the whistle on that?
I presume because he is and nobody's listening, or he's not. Maybe they make it in South Carolina.
He's worried about being arrested in Russia now. I think that's probably what's up.
Well, he can't go there. That's right.
That's what Wings will have on his mind. Okay, so we wait for a committee vote on this and then possibly a full House vote tomorrow. The other thing going on is in your home state of Texas, where Republicans have impeached the Republican attorney general. And
that is a wild story.
I'm a little surprised by that. I know it has no bearing on what's happening here in Washington State, but I think some people found it fascinating that the Republicans would impeach a fellow Republican. He must have done something really, really bad. What did he do?
Well, so this, Ken Paxton is the attorney general in Texas, and he is under indictment for securities fraud and has been for years, but he keeps sort of succeeding in delaying the trial by different motions about where to hold the trial. He also has been sued by his own subordinates for harassment and, you know, bribery and all kinds of other bad conduct. And so he's also fighting with the House Speaker in Texas, who's a Republican, but a more moderate Republican. Paxton is more from the Trumpy wing of the party. So there's all this sort of political backstory. But the precipitating event that caused this to boil over was the attorney general settles a lawsuit with his former subordinates for $3.3 million. So I think he settled with three people for $3.3 million. And he then goes to the legislature and asks them to pay, you know, to appropriate taxpayer money to pay off the settlement caused by his bad conduct.
Wow.
And I think the legislature saw that as a step too far, appointed a committee nominally to investigate whether they should pay this money, but really just to investigate Paxton. And it ended with, in really ugly fashion, but with the attorney general getting impeached, and with the attorney general accusing the House Speaker, sort of who's behind his impeachment, of being drunk on the House floor.
Yikes. Well, was there the smell of alcohol in his breath? Do we know who's right here?
Well, there's a video in which he seems to slur his words, but apparently the segments before and after, he seemed normal. So it may have just been, it may have been something else. Also, to be honest,
people drinking, being drunk on the floor of a state legislature is nothing new. I don't know if it happened in this case, but that would not be surprising to anyone who's covered a state legislature.
Well, the other thing now that he's been impeached in the House, he goes on trial in the Senate later this year, and among the members of the Senate is his wife. How is she going to vote on this?
Exactly. Well, it's interesting because he is removed from office until he's tried in the Senate. So he's out of a job, at least temporarily, until the Senate tries him. The head of the Senate, the lieutenant governor, is a close ally of his. But I don't know. It will be interesting to see how the Senate rules. They may just decide he's an embarrassment. They want to get rid of him and, you know, have somebody else in there.
Is being a news reporter in Texas pretty much a dream job these days, David?
Yeah, I think it would be a lot of fun. The state legislature in Texas, for a state that is controlled entirely by one party, which you think would make it boring, has been very, very interesting the last couple of years.
David Farenthold from the New York Times. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.